Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1999. The New Protocols.
Hello. I was amused to note that Bill Clinton's twin across the great water, Tony Blair, struck another blow for democracy and equality last week. On October 19th, Blair's Jewish Home Secretary, Jack Straw, announced that henceforth, lunatics would be entitled to vote in all elections in the United Kingdom. Previously, people confined to lunatic asylums were not permitted to vote, the assumption being that a voter ought to be a responsible citizen who understands what he's doing and can make a rational choice. Of course, that was just hypocrisy. Nobody really believed that voters knew what they were doing. Football fans and Jamaican immigrants and couch potatoes on the dole were allowed to vote. That's how Tony Blair became prime minister. So why not let lunatics vote too? They can be unstrapped from their beds and given a pencil and a ballot just long enough to stab the appropriate spot on the paper. What's wrong with that? I mean, if we really believe that everyone is equal, let's show it. I'm just kidding, of course, but Jack Straw isn't. Lunatics really will be given the vote in the United Kingdom. The Jewish Home Secretary told the press last week that his move to give mental patients the vote will be, quote, a major landmark in this country's electoral history, end quote. Yes, undoubtedly it will rank right up there alongside Magna Carta. Did you ever wonder why the Jews are such great proponents of democracy? Whether in Indonesia or Pakistan or Serbia or you name it, whenever there is some threat to universal suffrage, the Jews are ready to send the U.S. armed forces in and bomb and kill until everyone is permitted to vote. Why is that? Why can't the Indonesians have an Islamic theocracy if they want? Why can't the Pakistanis have a military dictatorship? Why can't the Serbs run their own country the way they prefer? What is the appeal in making sure that people whose minds have been wasted by Alzheimer's disease vote? Well, let's not beat around the bush. The appeal of mass democracy lies in the fact that in essentially every country in the world today, the number of persons unable to think for themselves is substantially higher than the number able to make independent decisions. Those unable to think for themselves have their thinking done for them by the people who control the mass media. Which is to say, democracy is the preferred system because it gives the political power to those who own or control the mass media, and at the same time allows them to remain behind the scenes and evade responsibility for the way in which they use that power. And the more inclusive the democracy is, that is, the more Alzheimer's sufferers and mongoloid cretins and paranoid schizophrenics and people who live in empty packing cases in alleyways and Jamaican immigrants and football fans are able to vote, the more certain is the grip of the media masters on the political process. Those voters who buy astrology magazines at the checkout stand and spend their time watching soap operas, game shows, and Oprah absorb their general attitudes on things through the television screen. They learn which ideas are fashionable and which are not by noticing the facial expression and tone of voice of Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather when the news is announced each day. Their opinions on specific issues are formed as they view televised sidewalk surveys taken by reporters. The only uncertainty about these people is whether or not they'll be able to pry themselves loose from their couches long enough to vote for the designated candidates. That's why it's important to have lots of them. And wherever there are lots of them, the men who control the mass media also will control the outcome of elections. It's a much surer way of controlling governments than bribing corrupt dictators or slipping seductive whores into the king's bedroom, a la Esther and Ahasuerus, or Monica and Bill. Believe me, one day soon, the Jews on both sides of the Great Water will institute a web TV voting system that allows the couch potatoes and the ball game fans to vote without having to get up from their couches, just by clicking their remote controls at their TV screens to select the next president or prime minister. That'll be real democracy. You know, back close to the beginning of this century, around 1901 or so, a book first was published containing the text of what became generally known as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. The publisher was a Russian academic, Professor Sergei Nilus. Nilus himself allegedly had obtained the protocols from a Russian official, who had obtained the text from a patriotic Russian noblewoman, who in turn had purchased the material from a Jew in Paris about 15 years earlier. The protocols purports to be a collection of minutes or reports of meetings held by the leaders of the world Jewish community, at which they summarized the progress they had made to that time in their quest for world subversion, world ownership, and world power, and outline their plans for continuing the process in the future. They talk about gaining control of the banking systems of various countries, about fomenting wars and revolutions to weaken and destroy Gentile power, about corrupting music and art and education, about subverting various Gentile institutions, about taking over the press everywhere and controlling the flow of information to the masses, about undermining the family and bringing family values into disrepute, and so on. The Elders of Zion really are a satanic bunch of schemers. Reading the protocols makes one's flesh crawl. We should remember that when the protocols began circulating in Russia in the first decade in this century, that country had not yet fallen victim to Jewish Bolshevism. But that wasn't for lack of trying on the part of the Jews. The Jews were generally recognized as a dangerously subversive element in Russia, as the schemers and string pullers behind every attempt to damage or upset the established order in Russia. And so Professor Nilus's publication of the protocols found a ready market among the Russian public. After the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 overthrew the Russian government and established a communist dictatorship in Russia, anyone found with a copy of the protocols was liable to be summarily shot. The text already had been translated into a dozen other languages and distributed far and wide outside Russia, however. Since then, it has been published in virtually every language which has a printed form and has been read by tens of millions of people around the world. The Jews have been claiming hysterically since the protocols first appeared that the text is, quote, a forgery. I guess that's their way of saying that it's not what it purports to be, namely, the actual minutes of meetings of Jewish leaders discussing their plans for world domination. The great American industrialist and automaker Henry Ford was very strongly impressed by the protocols and helped circulate the text in the United States. When told by newspaper reporters in 1921 about the Jews' claims that the protocols was a forgery, Mr. Ford responded that all he could say about the material was that it fit what was actually happening in the world and had been happening ever since the protocols first appeared in print. Of course, what Mr. Ford had especially in mind when he made that remark were two momentous things which had happened during the previous decade. One was the Jews' success in taking over Russia and imposing communism on the Russians. And the other was the recently ended First World War, a horribly fratricidal and senseless war which had destroyed the old order in Europe, had spilled the blood of millions of the best Europeans, and had weakened all of Europe's long-established institutions, leaving every European country open to all manner of social, political, and cultural ills, in particular to the further spread of communism. Well, Henry Ford was a hard-headed, practical sort of man, and it's easy to understand his attitude. He had no way of knowing whether or not the protocols of the learned elders of Zion was actually what it purported to be. But he was quite impressed by the fact that the plan for world subversion and domination by the Jews outlined in the book seemed to be happening pretty much as described. I'll go a step further than Henry Ford was willing to go in assessing the protocols. I think that they very likely are not what they purport to be. In the first place, the text of the protocols doesn't ring true. It's too straightforward, too open. It doesn't use the sort of deceptive, weasel word, self-justifying language that Jews customarily use in expressing themselves, even to one another. When a group of Jewish leaders get together to discuss their plans for the destruction of a host nation, they don't use straightforward expressions such as encouraging miscegenation and leading the goyim to the slaughter. They use weasel expressions such as building tolerance, increasing diversity, and eliminating inequality. In the second place, it's difficult for me to imagine the head Jews laying out such a complete, self-contained, and pat explanation of what they're up to. It's just too convenient for those of us who aim at alerting our people as to what the Jews' intentions are and then putting a monkey wrench in their gears. I wouldn't call the protocols a forgery, as the Jews do whenever the book is mentioned. I'm inclined to believe Professor Nealis was an astute observer of the Jews and also was a patriot. He wanted to warn the Russian people of what the Jews were planning to do to them, and so he imagined how the Jews' plan might look if it were all laid out in straightforward language. I believe that he wrote the text he published, but that he believed it was a reasonably accurate description of what the Jews actually were doing. And the reason that the protocols ended up being translated into hundreds of languages and read by millions of people is that many people, like Henry Ford, saw that they fitted what was happening. Sometimes I have tried to imagine what Professor Nealis might have written if he were writing today instead of a century ago, and if he were writing still in the straightforward sort of language he used earlier. A 1999 version of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion might read something like this, and I quote, "Greetings, my fellow elders of Zion. Today I am happy to report to you that our plan for the destruction of the hated Gentiles and the acquisition of their remaining wealth is practically complete. There remain only a few loose ends to tie up, and then the struggle in which we have been engaged for thousands of years against the filthy goyim, against the nations, against all the non-Jewish peoples of the world, finally will be victorious, and we will be able to devour everything they have created as Yahweh, the God of our tribe, has commanded us. Everywhere we already rule behind the scenes, with puppets completely under our control in the offices of power. In Russia, where they resisted us for so long, where the ordinary people always hated us as exploiters, as moneylenders and tax collectors, and purveyors of alcohol, and merchants in the sweet white flesh of their daughters and sisters, and where the aristocrats also hated us as subversives and troublemakers and kept us confined to only certain areas of the country so that we could not exploit all of the people. In Russia, we used the doctrine of our dear departed elder of Zion, Karl Marx, to divide the Russian people against themselves and get the power into our own hands, where it remains to this day. We butchered their Tsar and his whole family like the Gentile cattle they were. With the help of the common people, we slaughtered all of the Russian aristocrats and took their wealth. And then we turned on the common people. First, we murdered their leaders, their writers and teachers and intellectuals and military officers, so that there would be no one able to turn the people against us. And then we began murdering the common people themselves, the farmers and workers, first by the millions and then by the tens of millions in labor camps and death camps all across Russia. And most of them never did understand what was happening to them. One of them, who had been studying to become a Christian priest, we corrupted and made into our ally. His name was Stalin. Later, like the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, Stalin tried to turn against us, but one of our women was his doctor, and we poisoned him before he could harm us. When the system based on the theory of our departed elder, Marx, had bled the Russian people dry, we launched a privatization scheme which put most of the remaining wealth which had belonged to the government directly into our hands. Their gas and oil, their forests and their lumber industry, their mines and factories, and especially their television broadcasting facilities are now owned by us, acting as capitalists. Today we have a drunken, sick old Russian clown, Boris Yeltsin, as the nominal leader of the Russians. But one of our people, Boris Abramovich Berezovsky, tells him what to do and keeps him under tight control through bribes. In England, the country from which all of us were expelled by the king as exploiters and troublemakers just over 700 years ago, we now have another puppet, Tony Blair, in place as the nominal leader of the English. But like Yeltsin, he is completely under our control. One of our people, Michael Levy, finances his election campaigns and controls his purse strings. Another of our people, Jack Straw, controls his domestic policies. America, however, is the prize example of our success. Just as in England and in Russia, also in America, we have been able to put a totally corrupt Gentile politician into the position of nominal power and then to surround him with our own people who wield the real power. Actually running the American government, our people are in charge of America's State Department, America's Defense Department, America's Federal Reserve System, and America's Treasury Department. When one of our people, Robert Rubin, retired recently as Secretary of the Treasury, we simply moved another of our people, Lawrence Summers, into that position. Clinton appoints to every high office in the American government, whether the Supreme Court or his own cabinet, only those people we suggest to him, and the totally corrupt politicians of the Senate dare not disapprove anyone we suggest, lest we label them as anti-Semites. We have gained nearly complete control of America's educational system from kindergarten through the universities. No ideas or facts may be taught unless we have given them the stamp of political correctness. We have made it impossible for anyone in an American university to contradict anything we have claimed, no matter how preposterous, about what happened to us during the Second World War. We now have the American government, just like every government in Europe, paying us reparations because not enough was done for us during the war. We have succeeded in corrupting and then dominating America's art and music and literature. We have made degeneracy the touchstone for American culture. We own the art galleries and set the standards for painting and sculpture. We have the Americans lining up and paying admission to see a work of art which consists of animal dung smeared onto a crude painting of a negress, which we tell them is their Virgin Mary. They read the depraved and trashy novels we tell them to read and believe that these novels are literature. Their children listen to Negroid rhythms and chant Negroid rap ditties because we control the popular music industry. Through the immigration policy we have imposed on America, we are increasing the percentage of non-white minorities in every part of the country. Within the next few years, we will succeed in making white Americans a minority in their own country. Our success in America has been due to two things: our control of the mass media of news and entertainment, through which we control the ideas and attitudes of the masses, and the system of mass democracy, which ensures that the votes of the masses under our control determine which figurehead politicians actually make up the American government. Since the last part of the 19th century, we have been gathering the power of the mass media into our own hands. In those days, many of us were only rag pickers and dealers in used merchandise, recently off the boat from Russia or Poland. But whenever a Gentile newspaper got itself into financial difficulties, we were ready instantly to pool our resources and buy it out so that henceforth it could be in the hands of one of our people. In the 1920s, when radio was becoming a powerful medium of persuasion, we began buying broadcasting stations and putting together networks. At the same time, we saw the potential for motion pictures and began moving into Hollywood. By working together with each other, we were able to bankrupt or buy out every Gentile film producer except Walt Disney. We had to wait until he died to take control of his film company, but by then we already dominated the entire motion picture industry. After the Second World War, when television became the most powerful medium of mass persuasion, we were ready to move in and dominate the TV industry from the beginning. Today, no motion picture can be made and no television program can be broadcast in America without our approval. Only a few independent commercial radio stations, a few shortwave radio stations, and a handful of book and magazine publishers remain free of our control. But the American masses, for the most part, never see or hear anything we have not approved. They do not understand shortwave, and they are afraid to read any publication we have not approved for fear that it might be hate material. There is, of course, that pesky Internet, which is not yet under our control, but we are moving rapidly to deal with that matter. We expect soon to have our puppet politicians enact hate speech legislation in America, similar to that which we already have succeeded in having enforced in Europe, so that no one can say anything on the Internet which has not been approved by us. The couch potatoes will not object, because we will tell them that the new laws will make them safe from terrorism. By that time, we also should have achieved our goal for the disarmament of the American population. And then, my fellow elders of Zion, we can do to the American people what we did to the Russian people. With our power of television, we will have them voting for their own slaughter. Long live our mass media! Long live democracy! Long live the power of triumphant Zion! Thanks for being with me again today.